Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome to The Critic podcast. Today, I'm joined by Patrick Porter, regular contributor to these pages. Patrick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Patrick, you recently wrote for us about David Lammy doctrine, otherwise known as progressive realism. Now, so would you like to tell us a little bit about what progressive realism is and why it can never be?
Sure. Thanks for asking. Progressive realism is an attempt to marry two things that are often seen as separate and conflicting, an attempt to create a more just social order and an attempt to grasp and work with the brutal realities of power politics, and to do those things abroad in a way that is faithful to the Labour tradition of foreign policy. I think it's partly as much as anything driven by what it's against. It knows what it doesn't like very much. It doesn't like the cavalier relationship with rules and law that it sees as embodied in Trumpism or Rees-Moggism or Johnsonism. It doesn't like disrespect of alliances and institutions. In fact, it positively reveres alliances and institutions almost as ends as much as means. And it's an attempt to offer the people of Britain something different from whatever those things are that got us where we are over the past few decades or so, sort of economic setback and almost ruin at times, economic crisis anyway, of disappointing wars. And
so that was the progressive side, and now the realist.
Well, that's where it gets a little murky. Because what I think, once you drill down into the Lammy doctrine, and I think in many respects, at least there should be some credit here, this is an attempt to give us something different from the surrealism doctrine, the surrealist doctrines that got us here. It's an attempt to refocus on what works, and that's okay. But I call that pragmatism, not realism. Realism is an ancient and much more pessimistic view of what can work, given what realists see as the world around us and what can't be changed. So a realist is not someone who's just realistic. That would be hubristic to say. Lots of different people from different schools try and be realistic, and Marxists think they're very realistic too about what can work. But it's the framework you put that in, and realists put that in a framework where certain things are inexorably real. That is, we live in a state of anarchy where there is no big daddy, no 999 to look after us, where war and the possibility of war is the defining feature and the persistence of it, where competition is the natural reflex of the international system, where cooperation is very fragile, and where we're ultimately alone. We cannot look to institutions, alliances, or anyone else to come and save us. And that's where Lammyism, Starmerism, is different from what I would regard as what realism is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think part of the problem here is that there's realism with a capital R, and there's realism, as the Foreign Secretary puts it. Mm-hmm. What he's interested in, I think, is a kind of pragmatic version of liberal internationalism. And that, if you're going to be that, you need to know that's what you're advocating and what it leads to and why it's different from the words you're using. Whereas announcing a doctrine of progressive realism and everyone having to scrutinize what it really means, you might well run into trouble when crises present difficult choices, which they are indeed now.
So, I mean, you've just laid out quite concisely the realist worldview, but people who are not as sort of familiar with IR terms, realism, it's as you've laid out, it's this view that international relations are fundamentally determined by power relationships, and I mean, at least as best I understand it, and that the way we navigate it best is by understanding it in those terms. Now, what's stopping one, you know, pursuing a progressive aims whilst recognizing that realist picture? Isn't that just what Lammy's doing?
No, because his version of it, if to judge from the speeches and the declarations, is not just to build a more egalitarian order at home whilst recognising the reality of militarised power politics abroad. It's to try and change abroad, to make the world out there more domesticated, more ruled by rules and institutions, more governed, less arbitrary, less prone to relapses into violence, etc. I mean, realism is about the primacy of insecurity and power in international life. And it doesn't claim to explain everything, but it claims to explain, in the aggregate, the main tendencies. And there were Labour leaders like Clement Attlee and Nye Bevan, who you could say were progressive realists in the more narrow sense. They wanted to build the National Health Service. They wanted to build a socialist Britain. But they also wanted nuclear weapons, and they also wanted to contain the Soviet Union, because out there in that wild world outside the city walls, a different set of patterns prevailed. And you couldn't just trust in things like the United Nations when you had Stalin and 150 divisions parked on the lawn. Whereas to hear progressive realism with the way it's talked now, it's a much more, in a sense, ambitious attempt to replace a world of power with a world of law.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a nice idea, the idea of, you know, it would be great if, you know, international relations were determined by law and rules. But I suppose, I mean, putting it from a realist perspective, I suppose part of the problem is, I mean, it's no good saying we would like it to be ruled by laws and rules if there is not a rule enforcer. You know, so if I break the law, the police come and arrest me. But who? Yeah. This becomes very quickly becomes the problem. If you're trying to enforce
ideally
nationally, who is going to enforce? You know, who's going to do the job?
Well, indeed, and so that's part of the problem, is that there isn't a reliable, disinterested umpire to enforce the rules, to interpret the rules, to enforce them consistently in a fair way. But I would actually go further. I personally, and a lot of realists, don't desire a world with the supreme Leviathan. Mm. Because that would be an unacceptable concentration of power that could then threaten us, because that thing would have to be human and therefore fallible and therefore prone to, you know, putting on the ring in Lord of the Rings, becoming corrupted, and it would require balancing against it. That could actually be quite a dangerous thing. I would prefer to deal with anarchy as we have it and prevent any one state from even getting close to being that thing. So actually, it's not just nice, like, debates about communism, not just, oh, it wouldn't be great if we could have it, we can't have it. No, having the thing would threaten us.
Yeah, I mean, the perspective I come from, I'll just say, not that this is about my views and everything, but, I'm a Christian, and I have there's a very strong tradition going back a very long time to this idea. There's something called Christendom. There's the idea that there might not be someone who's physically got the power to make you behave well internationally, but there might be someone with the moral authority to do so. So there's the idea that, like, okay, we're going to limit how we fight each other because we have certain things in common, because we understand there's some ultimate, you know, divine justice that we appeal to. And obviously that's very hard if you're dealing with something like, you know, China and the West, you know, both modern secular states. But I do think something like Lammy's progressive realism, you know, it's often said that Labour is a kind of secularised religious movement, you know, Methodism without God, with God in many cases.
Yes.
I wonder if it's speaking to an appetite people have for an international order that isn't just, you know, a state of nature, that actually there is some sense of we're able to find some kind of humanistic common ground, even if the religious one's gone.
Oh, I think it very much is looking to speak to that, and has done for a long time. And that's where the appeal of, you know, the idea of Britain as a force for good, that there is this goodness out there that can be looked to and shared. All a realist would say back is that's fine, but it's very fragile and you need a plan B. So when Stalin was told about the papacy denouncing Stalin's policies in Eastern Europe, he said, well, how many divisions has he got? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I would also say, as probably a much less good Christian than you, realism also flows out of a Christian tradition in the West, at least. I mean, there is realism outside the West. There's a long tradition of realism in China and India as well, Kautilya, etc. But realism also flows out of a debate within Christianity from the Augustinian tradition of what do we do in a fallen world. So It's one thing to imagine the just city and the celestial standard, but what about the standard in a world where there isn't the ultimate authority except one after death? And so a lot of the debate around Machiavelli and power and cynicism actually comes out of a very intense medieval question there.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not going to plunge our viewers completely into the intricacies of theology and international relations. That's a whole podcast in itself. But I'd say it's certainly interesting. I mean, it's interesting that sort of Augustine is very realist about the nature of power, but he's also says, you know, he's also an idealist about how you should use it in principle. So he's very clear. He says, you know, that the Roman Empire was wrong to go and conquer everyone, that they should have, that if they expanded, it should have been through alliances and through extending citizenship and friendship. So it's an interesting, you know, so in a sense he's pragmatic, but he, you know, a progressive realist in his day in a way. But maybe a real but maybe the real deal. But anyway, moving away from abstraction for a moment. Lamy doctrine, you know, we can discuss the merits of it intellectually, but we're beginning to see, I think, what it might look like in practice. So there's been a lot of controversy recently for those following it about handing over potentially of the Chagos Islands. Now, just for those who don't know, you know, the Chagos Islands are a set of islands very remote in the Indian Ocean, not really close to anywhere. They had inhabitants, the Chagossians, and they were removed. You know, under the days of the British Empire, to create a military base that's very important, strategically important, called Diego Garcia, and that's now in question. So, Labour has arrived at a deal with the government of Mauritius, another island nation in the Indian Ocean, to, so as it's been put, return the islands. Now, you know, they secured supposedly a 99-year lease on the military base, so in theory that's secure, but there's rather more to it than that, isn't there, Patrick?
Well, indeed. I mean, this is where very early some of the tensions within progressive realism fall very squarely on the table. I think there is a tension between progressivism and realism, because the progressivist looks to a more absolute morality, that if you believe the possession of the Chagos Islands, and specifically Diego Garcia, is stolen property and illegal, then you are probably obliged to take that position into the discussion and offer it back, no holds barred. But that's not what happened. Britain made very clear, as far as I can tell, that the very strong precondition on any handover was that Britain keeps the base. And I applaud wanting to keep the base, but that's not progressivism. That is a hard caveat there, that we're going to keep the main thing that we care about. And if not, the discussion's off the table. The whole thing's off the table. And that's okay too, but presenting that in very ideal politic, moral politic terms obviously begs criticism. You're setting a standard by which you're failing to live up to. I mean, there's also a problem here that, from reports anyway in the BBC, that the actual original inhabitants, the Chagossians, were not involved at all in the discussion. It was a deal, a brokering between two states, one of which, Mauritius, some argue, has played Britain here. They've exploited this, a sense of colonial grievance. And that's one of the difficulties of progressive realism, that it takes a lot of global South grievance at face value, rather than recognizing that the global South, as we call it, is full of ruthless nation states who are pursuing their hard material interests and using whatever lever they can. That the people most directly affected and possessed were hardly involved, and many of them actually prefer Britain to Mauritius to begin with, given Mauritius's behaviour with them. And whilst Britain and the United States do keep a lease, the whole thing is now vulnerable to Mauritius cutting deals with another certain great power in the region and the other islands involved.
Yeah, and
This is all very fraught stuff.
my understanding, I mean, I think they've already leased an island to India in Mauritius. So this is, you know, and got around forced the inhabitants to move out. So this is, you know, so this is a very pragmatic power. And the thing I find interesting about the Diego Garcia deal, the Chagos Islands deal, is that there are, from the perspective of what you've been telling me, is that there are three kind of different bits that maybe don't completely add up together. So on the one hand, Labour is saying that they had no choice, that there is an international criminal court ruling that they've got to, that you know that that they have to come to some kind of terms from Mauritius. So there's that sort of sense of, oh, we've got to have this international rule of law. And then there's the second thing, which is, as you pointed out, is this very pragmatic thing of, but of course, we've got to have the military base. We've got to keep America happy. That's pure power politics. But then there's this third thing, which is they're also going to provide all of this economic aid to Mauritius as part of the deal. And that seems to be entirely a kind of, oh, we've got to compensate for imperialism. We've got to, this is part of decolonization and, you know, even reparations. And that belongs to yet another strain. So this isn't about the rule-based order. There's no obligation of Britain to do this. This is entirely about their own sort of sentiments. So, I mean, how do those three fit together or not at all?
I don't think they fit together. And trying to throw them all together is creating a mess. I mean, first of all, if you want the base, let's be pragmatic, let's be super real. If you want the base and to have your position secure and optimized, then you don't want to cede sovereignty because otherwise the other bits within the vicinity can be ceded out and it can be quite endangered. So the rail politique is not quite achieved. If you want to say that from now on, Britain is going to feel bound and obligated by what is, as I understand it, actually a non-binding legal opinion, then are you going to really follow that precedent every time that comes up, no matter who is on the court, no matter which interests are represented, no matter how secure the judgment? No country on earth, no major power on earth has ever behaved that way, and nor could it behave that way. The world is too conflicted. National interests are too intense to be
This
reducible to rules like that. It doesn't work like that.
is
And Starmer going on like that and treating the world as a place that can be kind of tidied up and packed into a kind of lawyer's brief is a highway for trouble. He's going to have to then at some point violate that, right? Because Britain is not going to, Britain and no other power ever is going to consistently follow rules, right? And then this other thing about reparations and everything, again, that whether you like it or not, that does set expectations and precedents. And this country, I do not think, has the appetite to go on a systemic program of mass reparations. And other countries that demand it might find that it's hard for them too, once that comes home with their complicity in the international slave trade, etc. So it just comes to, I think it's all pretty incoherent stuff. And by the way, quite aside from anything else, it won't please anybody.
No, no one has
So
ever
yeah,
ten.
I mean, honestly, if you ask me what I would do, I would focus not on Mauritius but on the Chagossians and on the base. So I'm going to keep the base. Sorry, bad news, but we will provide you with the best possible material deal, including preference treatment on the base itself, as much as possible, a right of return, except for the base. But we're holding on to it, c'est la vie. At least that has some consistency and some honesty to it.
I
So
do.
anyway.
I know we've had a lot of skepticism about the idea of progressive realism, and I'm a skeptic about progressivism. But the idea of pursuing more idealistic ends whilst recognizing the nature of international politics is, that seems to be sort of what you're talking about. Like, we could just cut Mauritius out of the deal altogether, retain sovereignty, give the, compensate the Chagossians for genuine grievances, but not like entertain a foreign power's ambitions. I mean, and I don't see why we're always in the situation of we're apologizing for ourselves. We're somehow always subject to some external authority. There's kind of an unwillingness to take leadership in all this. I get this feeling like, oh, some kind of vague international body is going to do it all for us.
Well, indeed. I mean, I think again, to be a realist is not the same thing as to be just an amoral power seeker for its own sake. There is a morality in realism. It's called reason of state, but it also needs to be tempered by a kind of human sympathy where it can be applied. Sometimes a realist, a ruler governing as a realist, will have to do ruthless things like you couldn't do it, you couldn't condone in private life, like Churchill sinking the Vichy fleet while the sailors are in their ship. But where there is room and space, it does involve some humane impulse. But that's, I think, again, that's different from what progressive realism is proposing, which is something much more systemic and ambitious. On this point about grievance and the past and all of those sort of things. I think it's one thing, again, to acknowledge what the state has done and to confront that, and where necessary, to recognizing it. But you cannot carry on in this brutal world with other ruthless nation states as an apologetic power. You'll get kicked to death. Every major power in history has a brutal imperial past. That's how they became a major power. And to actually do that would be to fall prey to what are other countries in the world. If you look at the way a lot of other countries in the world that are non-Western democracies, all the way from South Africa to Brazil to India to Israel, the way they reacted to the invasion of Ukraine was not to organize their country's stance around opposition to colonialism, but to hedge and to pursue their material interests and offer the Ukrainians at most ceremonial support while pursuing that. That's the world we live in. That's the audience we have. That's the environment. And so Britain needs to be very careful about the way it talks to those countries and needs not to be naive. Those are not countries that spend all day and all night grieving about the empire. They are countries that spend all day and all night thinking about themselves, just like us.
Yeah, and I'm struck also that there's I do think there's been a shift that okay, there was always a sort of oh, we love the Soviet Union, we're going to apologize for revisionist powers tendency in the West, but I do think in the past it felt like self-critique was part of the strength of the West in things like the Cold War, that you know we were the societies that were going to allow criticism, that you know when an official screwed up, they were going to be criticized in the press. You know, we weren't going to run a broken system into the ground. We had a capacity for reform and self-critique. But it sort of feels like our capacity for self-critique has almost sort of exploded and it sort of metastasized into this sort of civilizational kind of self-hatred. Like it's not just we should criticize ourselves harshly in order to become a better culture. It's we should criticize everything about our civilization and maybe regard other civilizations as superior. And that feels sort of, I think you know, Roger Scruton called it oikophobia, you know, sort of people really just dislike things that are their own.
Well, indeed, and I think that flows from rather a shallow account of history where empires begin and end with the West, where in fact empire and genocide is almost a universal phenomenon to begin with. And secondly, it's to reduce Western history to empire rather than to recognizing the whole mosaic of it. Yes, Britain was up to its eyeballs in brutal exploitation, the slave trade, the Middle Passage, but it was also up to its eyeballs in defeating the Axis powers and indeed suppressing the slave trade and things like that and building NATO. And so it's a mixed bag. And what I worry about is not that we have self-criticism, as you say. I mean, one of the reasons we have a foreign policy is to protect our liberty so we can have self-criticism. That's one of the points of our foreign policy. We want to preserve a free way of life. What I do worry about, though, is what diplomats and our representatives talk about when they go into the room with foreign envoys. And what I think they should be talking about is business, not walking in to invite a rolling seminar on why we're bad in the past. We cannot conduct our foreign policy that way because Britain is responsible for the fate of 60 million people. And that is at the forefront. And so, and we need to remember that because the countries on the other side are not simply colonial subjects who are still grieving about the Raj. The likes of Mauritius, the likes of South Africa, play a much more brutal, cynical game, and we need to remember that.
Yeah, and I mean, there is definitely a sort of, I feel like, forgotten the sense that there is actually something moral about national self-interest, not to any extreme or to any point, but you know, the basic responsibility of a state to its own citizens. You know, when that's betrayed, when the government doesn't act in the interests of the people who are counting on it to represent them, something has gone wrong. And I do think in stuff like, you know, like this decision. On the terms which it was made. I mean, you do get a feeling of a government that's not necessarily got it's not got as its first priority, is this going to benefit British people?
Well, indeed, and recognizing as well that what is in the national interest will of necessity be at odds with the interests of many other people quite a lot of the time. The world is not a convenient harmony of interests. It's not a nice drawing room where what's good for one is good for everyone else. There is a zero-sum quality to it. I mean, that's just true. Unequal economic growth, differential economic growth does involve losses of opportunities for others, etc. It is competitive. And there are times where, as well, that might lead to doing things that large parts of international opinion disapprove of. When we look out over the city walls and look outside, what do we see? Some people see a united species. I don't see that. I see many different peoples who want many different things and who have very different kinds of regimes, many of which will exploit every opportunity. And in a sense, the international community, the idea of an international community, in some respects, is quite a dangerous construct. We don't have an international community. We have international anarchy. Sometimes we can cooperate with them that and do some good. But other times, we have to be pretty hard-nosed about things.
And there is this pattern, I think, of giving moral authority to self-interest of other nations. So, you know, if nations in the so-called global south exert their own national interest, it's seen as a form of, I think, by certain segments of the left, it is seen as a kind of a liberation struggle that has to be supported. Whereas when the West exerts its self-interest, it's imperialism.
Well, exactly. And you don't have to look very far to see the shallowness of that. South Africa helps to launch an international court case against Israel whilst happily welcoming some of the architects of the genocide in Sudan in for tea and discussions. Egypt joins in that court case, but will not open that border, the border with Gaza. And indeed, at one point was caught covertly preparing to ship arms to Russia as it rapes Ukraine. You don't have to actually not see that takes quite a lot of active not seeing.
No, and you do get this feeling that maybe at its very worst, progressive realism ends up being progressive when it comes to giving things away, but realist when it comes to ignoring what countries like South Africa get up to. But on that quote, you mentioned Israel, and obviously at the moment, I just want to turn away from the Indian Ocean to the Middle East, which is never exactly a happy topic, but at the moment, probably a lot of people are sort of watching things blow up and wondering where it's all headed. I mean, obviously people like to sort of start saying World War III every time there's a fight in the Middle East. That may not be quite true, but how bad could it get? You know, just for listeners, we're currently seeing, you know, it's probably hard, probably everyone already knows, but, you know, Israel's, you know, launched attacks in retaliation against Hezbollah in Lebanon. Iran has attacked Israel, and Israel is now considering strikes in retaliation against Iran. So there's a clear sort of escalatory pattern going on here.
Yeah. Oh, look, cut a long story short, I think it's bad, but I don't think it's going to become a general war. Certainly not. It's certainly not going to be the tinderbox for a world war, I don't think. Just, I mean, you can quote me on that. So people at times tend to infer from brutality a transformation. But in fact, I don't think we're seeing a transformation. I think we're seeing an intensification of Israel's struggle with Iran and Iran's proxies. That's true. And a lot of people are going to suffer. That's true. But what we're also seeing are the dogs that aren't barking. The Gulf monarchies, the sort of Saudi bloc, the likes of Egypt as well, who do not want this to disrupt things like the Abraham Accords, who want to maintain their coalition against Iran, who keep a very careful managing eye on their own populations, allowing some dissent over Palestine, but not to the point where it might start pressuring them to distance themselves from Israel. And indeed, a lot of the populations of the region, particularly in the non-Shia sort of Arab Islamic world, who are very wary of what they went through not so long ago, which was these disappointing revolutions, this disappointing so-called spring that led to terrible violence and chaos followed by a restoration of the strongmen. So there's a kind of, I think that what's going on there is as much an aversion to unlimited risk as risk.
Yeah.
And an aversion to revolution and an aversion to international war. And I don't, for all of the strife, and there's a lot of strife, and I don't want to underestimate that, I don't see it in the way some people are seeing it as a kind of what they see as the Balkans in 1914, which I also don't think is what exactly caused World War One either. But there is a kind of idea that there is a vacuum and a disaster which then draws everyone in and causes a general war. I don't think that's how general wars happen, by the way. They're usually willed by one aggressor. But I just don't, the evidence is not yet there for that. And if you look at the It also took Hezbollah quite a while to start taking these risks. So I can't confidently predict more in more detail than that, except to say that at the moment, if anything, the crisis has shifted to Iran. It's lost one of the pillars of its deterrence. Hezbollah has been dramatically weakened, not destroyed, but on its heels. It doesn't have that many means of deterrence apart from its missile program and Hamas and Hezbollah, and both of them now are under onslaught. And if anything, the crisis for it's it'll be frightened of looking like a paper tiger. That in itself could be dangerous. You'll feel that it has to act now to restore its prestige, if you like.
I mean, do you, I
But
mean,
I still think the most dangerous place on Earth is the Taiwan Strait, not Gaza or Lebanon.
yeah, I mean, do you, I mean, we'll get into Taiwan, but I mean, maybe this is too conspiratorial, but do you think there's a sense in which it's not completely in Israel's interest to totally take out Iran out of the game? So, I mean, at the moment, as you say, the Gulf is somewhat friendly to Israel, partly because they're so threatened by Iran that, during the Arab Spring, there was Shia groups that were uprising in the Gulf. There was a sense of menace from Iran, which of course was itself the product of a revolution. Do you think there's now, do you think there's a sense in which if the Iranian regime really was to fall apart and the Sunni world had no particular reason to be friendly to it, well, do you think it would lose its reasons to be friendly to Israel under those circumstances?
Quite possibly. I mean, I'm not sure Israel quite has the option exactly to take Iran out. I think Iran is in a depleted state at the moment, but it's I think one of the difficulties at the heart of Israel's general strategy over generations is that, unlike its enemies, Israel can never have a final resolution to security threats. It might be that an aggressor one day finally removes Israel, but Israel does not have the option of finality. It just has tomorrow and tomorrow and getting from one to the other, and a set of adjustments it has to keep making. Certainly, though, the fear of Iran has helped Israel and some of its neighbors neutralize some of their hostilities. I also think there is a, I mean, I'm not a Middle East expert, but it seems there is a residual fear of chaos out of the Arab Spring period, which we can underestimate in the West, what that was like. It's one thing to live under a despotism. It's another thing to live under the possibility of 10,000 despots. And I think that's also an operating factor.
Yeah, I mean, Syria and Libya are not, great source of examples if you're thinking about revolution.
Well, indeed. And I mean, it's a subject for another time, but we also need to have a better conversation in the West about why exactly this matters to us beyond human sympathy.
Yeah, because I mean, there is definitely this tendency I see for people that they approach things like the Israel-Palestine conflict and all the subsidiary ones very much in that kind of, well, I have this sympathy and thus I'm on the side of Israel, I'm on the side of Palestine. And it makes sense for people who are in Israel and Palestine to be on the side of their people, but I'm not entirely sure where that comes from with a lot of British people. I mean, I suppose one understands there are religious, Jews and Muslims are religious sympathies that come into play, but you see quite ordinary people on the left and right of British politics having very fervent opinions about it, and it's not entirely clear where that what's sort of driving it, other than kind of it being a proxy for political divisions here.
Very much so. And I think people project onto this conflict and onto these peoples, often without knowing terribly much about it, some of their own demons and their own politics, as you say. So for some, Israel is a bulwark for all, or bulwark defending all they hold dear. And as the kind of democratic outlier, the sort of Spartans defending the pass against the forces of darkness and or dictatorship, etc. But for other people, Israel is a proxy for white colonial guilt, that they very crudely and I think inaccurately portray Israel as nothing other than a European plantation, a European settler project, forgetting, of course, that many Israelis and their ancestors have been in the region for thousands of years, and that it's a deeply unserious an attempt to kind of have a pure ethnic account of who is an outsider and who is an insider. But that's not coming from a detailed knowledge of the region, it's coming from a preoccupation with the Western legacy of empire. And that does a lot of violence to the realities on the ground.
I don't think most people seem aware of the fact that I think about half of Israel's population is drawn from the Middle East. And
exactly, and North Africa.
And most of the population didn't have much choice about leaving their homelands. I mean, you know, a lot of them did choose to.
Indeed.
But, you know, there were pogroms in Iraq and things, and people fleeing into Israel.
Yeah.
And I think also people say, well, why are they running? As like, people like to term an apartheid state, there's some element of truth to it. But I also think anyone looking at what a pluralist state whereby you're an ethnic minority that's sort of in charge, but gradually you become a minority in your own country. Well, Lebanon tells you what that looks like in practice, you know, that an inclusive, you know, so I think these are kind of things people don't, I think they either don't know or they dismiss. I also find it hard to understand how something that's so discussed and so endlessly in the news that at some point, surely people, this sort of stuff would filter into people's heads, but it doesn't seem to.
Yeah, I mean, why one chooses to have very intense feelings about one thing and not comparable things elsewhere is something that people should ask themselves. And it may be there are good reasons to have firmer opinions about what we should do. Perhaps it's because we've got more to do with it. But I think there's something else going on here, which is it's about us and our and the way we project onto things. I mean, my own view is that for what it's worth, and this is not very interesting, it's not a very new view. I think October the 7th was a pogrom that was then followed by more or less a massacre.
Yeah.
I think Britain should suspend arms to the extent that arms are being misused. I agree with that policy. But I also think the whole region itself actually need not matter to us. As in, it doesn't actually objectively matter to us as much as we think it does, and that's an error. There are other parts of the world that matter much more intensely to this country and indeed to the United States.
Yeah,
and
that's an interesting question. We talk a lot about the things that are in the headlines that generate emotion, but what are the things, what actually are British overseas interests?
I think, first of all, closer to home, the balance of power in continental Europe and indeed its nautical, its maritime and air approaches, the security of the shipping lanes, and all of that. Once upon a time, we didn't have to worry too much about it, but we're looking at a world now where sooner or later, via a wandering path, we may wake up one day to see America turning to rich Europe and saying, you're going to have to shoulder most of the load yourself. We're too busy. We're too distracted. We're too divided. And we may be facing, if not a post-American region, certainly a much less America in it, where the hegemon increasingly refuses to pick up the tab. And so thinking about security provision where countries in Europe like Poland, Finland, Germany, Britain have to do much more themselves and get back to actually ententes and bargaining and coalitions. And I think we're intellectually not ready for that. We're still talking about the world under the unipolar construct of the 1990s. What leadership is America showing, and how is Britain going to steer America in the right direction? No, we're going to have to do some more ourselves. And that actually is about bread and butter questions much closer to the doorstep.
And why do you think it is that, I mean, we can understand why broad and British people maybe don't always have a firm grasp of what, you know, people have as much understanding as they can sort of grasp through the news and what they're told. But why do you think Britain's foreign policy elite seems to be so bad at this? I mean, you know, I mean, we've seen this deal with Diego Gazir and everything. I mean, is there no kind of institutional memory in something like the Foreign Office, or are they part of the problem?
So I think there are some, I mean, my own experience is there are some very good and skilled people quietly working in Whitehall who try and turn doctrines into workable policies and who try to wrestle within the constraints that this country is given. But I think one of the problems was that we won. But this country, in many fundamental respects, won. It was on the winning side of World War II. It was on the winning side of the Cold War and under the protective wing of a superpower. Those are not conditions conducive to rigorous means ends, hard-nosed thinking. So in a sense, we, and I'm allowed to say we because I've got the passport, we're the victims of our own success. That's a structural thing, not any particular party or government. And we grew up at a time when you didn't have to question such fundamentals as who provides security or can we be sure that the food will arrive in time onto the table? Remember that old grace, what the food we're about to eat, we thank the Lord and the British fleet. So it's partly that. I think there is a problem in the Foreign Development Office. That is, I think it's become developmentalized. There are a lot of people working in the Foreign Office, often very good people, very technically skilled people, but who view Britain not through the lens of the nation pursuing the national interests, but of Britain as a kind of large-scale charity doing good for the world. And that's a very different kind of foreign policy that's going to lead you to, and one that could be open to coercion and manipulation by ruthless powers. I think there is a lot less hard-nosed strategic thinking and a lot more good-natured altruism, but not ruthless strategy making. And I think that is a problem. I think, at least to the credit of David Lammy and to the new government, they are trying for something else. They are trying for something more pragmatic. And I want to give, I think that in that respect, the pint glass is half full. That I'd rather be dealing with this than, say, the global war on terror, or being important, steering America in the right direction as it battles global Islam and leading us to where it led, or the inanity of the Cameron Osborne era, which announces no strategic shrinkage while cutting the armed forces. So I think there is at least something to work with here.
I mean, but do you think there's the will to do it? I was struck by the decision of Starmer back in July not to offer a bailout to Holland and Wolf. Some of the decisions over, how we're going to service our aircraft carriers and things that come downstream of that as well. I mean, is that just like an error out of the gate from a new leader, or do you think that's indicative of a mindset that they're not going to prioritize, domestic supply chains?
I honestly don't know. We just don't know enough, to be honest with you. I mean, part of being a realist is recognizing that the world is dangerous, partly because we don't know a lot about it. And there are a lot of things, including what goes on in government, that we don't know. I think there is a tension, certainly within the government, between the desire for a foreign policy doctrine that's different and the pragmatic, and at the same time, a status quo bias towards saying, we have to get the economic and domestic house in order. Something that was reinforced by the summer riots, right? And that we don't want defense, security, international relations at all to present obstacles and problems and distractions to that. So we want to keep all of that as stable as possible and not open it up for a kind of big scrutiny. I mean, the Labour government having gotten elected for the first time since 2005, I imagine the first thing they're thinking is we've got to stay here. And to stay here, we've got to focus on what they want to do is focus on the domestic and on the economics and on sort of what the Americans would call social security. Unfortunately, foreign affairs don't always obey those priorities.
Indeed not. You're a realist, so there's a particular sort of sadism in me forcing you to play the prophet, but I'm gonna do it anyway. What do you force? So you've said that there are some things that we're overstating in terms of its impact on the UK. What do you think is coming down the track? You mentioned the Taiwan Straits. I mean, where do you think the trouble's going to come for Britain, for the world?
Well, I think, so first of all, I think that one of the main troubles which is coming down the pike is that America is going to decide increasingly that it can't do everything anymore, that it can't be a global power. It has to prioritize. It faces the largest, wealthiest peer adversary in its history in the region of the world that is becoming the most important, carrying the most economic weight, which is therefore a massive power center, the Indo-Pacific. It's got big problems at home to deal with and polarization. And it's got a Middle East, part of which is in flames. We already know that the Situation Room is overloaded with crises. They can't deal with all of it. The presidential time is a very precious and overstretched asset. Something's going to have to give, and I think the thing that's going to have to give, whether or not it's right and whether or not we like it, is the burden the disproportionate burden America carries in continental Europe. And at some point, that is a luxury that they're not going to be willing to shoulder anymore. It'll take a tremendous domestic fight to get there, but I think we'll get there. And so that's part of it, is the shock of doing much more ourselves. In terms of direct conflict, I still think, and I'm pessimistic, I think there is enormous capacity for a great crisis over Taiwan, because China wants it and America doesn't want China to have it, and they both are confident they can get the other one to back off. And there is a power shift underway in many respects. It's not that China is overtaking America, but it's closing the gap. And in some areas, like shipbuilding and ship replacement, it's exceeding America. And it's a sacred cause to China, and it's part of the point of its challenge to America's position, is to reunify itself on its terms.
Yeah.
And I don't think that is a thing that can be fudged or split down the middle for much longer. I do think there's going to be a great crisis there. And that could accelerate the thing I first said, which is, even especially then, America then turns to say, you're going to have to fill the gap here. So it's not that I think Britain would be embroiled or drawn into a war in Asia. I think Britain, like a lot of powers in Europe, could step back if it doesn't want to get involved. That's what powers tend to do. They seem to be quite selective. But it could be a more insidious thing, where we have to suddenly work out, without wanting to think about it, what we're going to do. But for a lot of people, that is too much to think about. They would much rather write op-eds saying how evil Trump is and how people shouldn't vote for him. Well, the Americans might vote for him, but even if they don't, I think this problem is coming.
Yeah, I mean,
Trump
and his supporters like to say he would have seen off all of these global crises. Do you think there's any truth in that, or is it just the usual bluster?
No, I don't think so. Trump almost got into a war with North Korea, don't forget, in 2017. He ended up actually doing what a lot of NATO hawks wanted him to do in Europe, and which helped to get us where we are, right? Because Russia, both imperialist and fearing for its security, wanted to push back and neutralize Ukraine. So I don't see that being different. Trump, if anything, was even more willing to indulge and accommodate Israel, and I don't think would have done much to get Israel to take Hamas more seriously as a threat leading to October the 7th. So I don't see the counterfactual working out that much better. But I do think with Trump, there was at least a greater sense that he might be willing to do tremendous violence that's disproportionate as part of deterrence.
Yeah.
But I don't see that as being enough to stop countries like China and Russia pursuing intense interests where they see those intense interests. It may have done a little around the edges here and there, but fundamentally, Trump as a foreign policy actor, apart from his sort of corruption and his kind of media-driven public outbursts, the actual set of policies, the concrete material policies, were in the end quite traditional.
Yeah.
No. And so we would be in a roughly similar position today as if he had won that election, I think.
Yeah, because I mean that's the thing. I mean, of America, you get much more of a sense as a foreign policy establishment. There's what people like to call the deep state. It does seem like a ship that's a lot harder to steer in a direction it doesn't want to go in, like overseas.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be a theory of deep state, but there is a foreign policy establishment. There is a set of long-standing ideas about American security that are hard to shake. But in order to actually overhaul American foreign policy, you need to be a much more serious actor than Trump. Trump, when it comes to actually really seriously changing American foreign policy, he's not serious. He's into showbiz. He's into the kind of TV modality. It takes a lot of sustained attention and also spending domestic capital to really take on the foreign policy establishment. And we haven't really seen that since Nixon and Kissinger in a way. So Trump is not ultimately the wrecking ball of American foreign policy. And I mean, that's shown by the fact that, remember, people said, well, Trump has been so contemptuous towards allies, he's threatening our alliances. Well, it didn't take long for people to queue up to join NATO after Russia invaded Ukraine. People still want to be part under the umbrella, whether it's Trump or Biden or anyone. They still rather Uncle Sugar. So,
I mean, do you
yeah.
think we often overstate the importance of personality in foreign policy? I
Yes, I
mean,
think we
I
do.
think, it's like Putin is invading Ukraine, and you have this
Yes.
attitude almost as if, oh, if only we could get rid of Putin, Russia would become nice, and
Yes. Yeah, I think we do. I think, I mean, I'm a realist, so, and realists have a bias, well, a bias, a presumption towards the structural and the long term and to the kind of frameworks. And in terms of the fundamentals, as you say, if you got rid of Putin, you wouldn't get rid of Putinism. A lot of, even a lot of Russian democratic dissidents and liberals have very traditional sort of czarist ideas about Russia's prerogatives and its near abroad. It's not like there's the Greens and the Liberal Democrats at Brighton waiting to take power in Moscow. There's a different set of assumptions. And I think it's much easier to think about personality. It's also much more melodramatic because then you can keep on saying, well, democracy's on the ballot, or something's on the ballot when people go and vote. Actually, it tends to be more glacial and more tectonic than that.
because I mean, there's been some very odd incidents, so like Zelensky coming to America basically to campaign for the camp for Kamala Harris. I mean, that was that was quite surreal, and I can't say it was, I thought, the smartest move he could have made, but.
No, indeed. I mean, it's one of the curiosities is you have an intensely lobbying system in America, and that has increasingly now features very partisan international interventions at the behest of those in America who invite people over. Netanyahu being invited over to Congress to denounce the JCPOA agreement with Iran over its nuclear program. As you say, Zelensky coming over to join the campaign trail. And it doesn't necessarily always work. It reminds me a little of when George W. Bush was running for re-election. And so the Guardian thought it would be witty to get a letter-writing campaign
I remember
into
that.
an electorate in Ohio. And if anything, people went the other way. I was so annoyed by it.
Can you imagine you and I, ho an Ohio voter, and
No.
some dear sort of lady from London has written you a letter saying, don't you realize that Mr. Bush is a terrible Christo-fascist? Oh well, I've changed my mind about all of it.
I mean, having just sort of agreed with you on overstating personality, I think what does matter a lot in crises is the cool-headedness of the leader. So I think any other president would have been in a similar situation as John F. Kennedy in 1962, opposing Russia's encroachment in on Monroe territory or America's sphere and putting theater nuclear missiles in Cuba. I think most American presidents would have felt obliged to oppose that. I'm very grateful that it was Kennedy and not someone else who was dealing with the extremely demanding hawks around him who wanted much more radical action than just a blockade. So to that extent, it does matter who's in power, but not in terms of the fundamental policy settings.
Yeah, but sort of the person in the room can make a huge amount of difference to the flow of events, but they're
To
not
the
going to.
crisis management, yes.
Yeah. So I mean, we've traversed most of the continents. I'm just take it back home for the last question. What should Britain be doing that it's not right now?
Preparing for a less American Europe.
What does that look like?
What it doesn't look like is trying to build some new institution or create some new formal thing. It's quiet building of what I would sort of call returning to the idea of the entente, the informal coalition planning, getting on the phone quietly, preparing to discuss things like the division of labor, military interoperability. It will annoy the Americans a great deal to do it, but I think it's worth it. But looking at more and more, and without asking first, at what Britain and its neighbours can do for themselves, rather than hoping against hope that America stays around and does it what we regard as its duty to look after us. And so that's kind of one thing. I think secondly, I think we need to rethink our whole approach to development. I think Britain should be generous, but that's different from saying Britain should go around developing other countries to become more like us, which is what development ultimately is. I think the focus should be much more on pragmatic alleviation of immediate distress for people who are in crisis, all the way down to, water, blankets, tents, etc. And That also then raises a further really hard question about immigration and borders. I think in order for there to be generosity, there first has to be order. And I think this country, in fact, despite what a lot of people say about it, is actually very generous in many ways. If you look at the targeted assistance to people from Ukraine, Hong Kong, Syria, Afghanistan, it's done a lot of good. But to do that well, there needs to be a sense of security and stability with it in order to do it for those who most need it, which is people who are fleeing persecution, who are fleeing genuine distress. And so you can't avoid sort of that conversation. And just saying you're going to smash the gangs is not going to get us to those fundamentals. But, you know, that's a number of things. Easy for me to say, but because I don't sit in the Prime Minister's chair, but I do pay my taxes, I do vote, so it's good occasionally to think about these things.
I do at least one of those. I'm not going to say which. Professor Porter, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I think we all appreciated your call for a compassionate rather than progressive realism.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.